It's grown much faster than I hoped, doing much better than I hoped, and I constantly have to pinch myself. Doing 100 cars a year, more or less, it works out, because there's two a week. It's becoming a bit harder. It's honestly a bit embarrassing, but I love it. I'm doing the cars that I have an interest in, and generally they'll go from sort of mid-50s, not all of them, but some mid-50s, up to early 2000s. Mm. Modern cars I have almost zero interest in.
Hello and welcome to Fueling Around. I'm Vicky Butler-Henderson.
And I'm Dave Vitti, bringing you the very best in motortainment every single week. Fueling Around is brought to you by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance.
Please press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from. So then, to this week's special guest. He is a man who is living the dream. He has turned his passion for cars into a full-time job. He has a YouTube channel called Number 27. He has got almost a quarter of a million subscribers, had more than 83 million views. He is Mr. Jack Pecoraro. Hello.
Thank you so much for a lovely introduction.
Oh, no, listen, how was the pronunciation? Because we just learnt before we started recording that Vicky did Italian GCSE, was it? Or Italian A-level?
Just GCSE, okay. Barely.
Was it? How was it?
No, it really shows. She got it
Pecoraro?
Bang on.
Yeah. Pecoraro.
It's supposed to be Pecoraro in Italian. And that's something that always comes foul when I'm trying to pronounce Italian names as well on YouTube for, you know, Italian car makes and so on. Because I have pretty much a flawless British accent, so people expect that. So when I say that kind of stuff, they sort of seem to find that I'm being maybe a bit pretentious and so on. Mm. And so I sort of fluctuate between one and the other. But anyway, no, that was great.
Good.
That was great.
Good, good. Strong start. Thank you so much for joining us. Big, big fans of the channel. I have to say, you know, the first thing I need to sort of talk to you about is the fact that I hold you almost entirely responsible for the fact that my procrastination habit is spiraling out of control, because I can spend literally hours on your channel getting lost on the different videos, which is a backhanded compliment. Two questions for me to kick off with. Firstly, where does the number 27 come from, and what indeed were you doing before you became a global YouTube sensation?
Okay, well, look, number 27, it's a bit of a disappointing story, so I'll keep it brief. But essentially, a lot of people think it's down to Villeneuve, because that's the number he had when he was world champion. Unfortunately, it isn't. I should pretend that. But when I started off the channel, I had a Porsche 964, which I did a lot of work to. It was a C4. They were very cheap at the time. Nobody wanted them, unlike now. And the C4s, the four-wheel drive ones, they weren't very good. You wanted two-wheel drive for the nice crisp feel, all the rest of it. So I even converted it from four to two-wheel drive. I lightened it considerably. And I wanted to get a name for it, because it was kind of like, to be honest with you, like a marketing thing. I wanted people to know that I'd done all this work on this car. So I wanted to come up with a name. And I was thinking, you know, what can I call it? What can I call it? And it was Cobalt Blue. And this just sounds so terrible. And the atomic number of Cobalt is 27. And so now,
I told you I shouldn't have asked it.
Yeah. And so I thought also the nice thing I thought at the time, this was 12 years ago, was that obviously I could have the atomic sign. So the little thing with, you know, the atom sign with 27, and it would look nice as a logo. And it all started because of that car. And as I started doing videos on that car, I had no background. I wasn't a photographer, nothing. I really enjoyed it, because I have a creative side, and most of my jobs, which we'll go into, I guess, didn't involve that. And so learning to film, going through the end result, editing and seeing it on, you know, the first ones were dreadful, but still I got so satisfied by looking at it. And I thought, you know, that's really kind of started bringing me in.
Yeah.
So was marketing then quite key to your previous job?
You know, I had a day a week that I was supposed to be working from home. I guess they'll know about it now if they didn't at the time. But anyway,
and that's your YouTube
some
day.
Of that day. Some of that day, I did my YouTube, because at around the same time, I did a really crazy thing just before lockdown and bought this old Ferrari 308.
I need to pinpoint you down on this one, because when I was growing up, I couldn't work out whether I needed Tom Selleck as Magnum PI in my garage or a Ferrari 308. You opted for the 308, and that all of a sudden catapulted your channel. So just tell us sort of what steps you took to make a living then out of these shenanigans.
We had COVID. And just literally a few days before the lockdown, I was looking for a Peugeot 205 on Silverstone auctions. There was one there, and I was going through that first day, looking at the cars, looking at the 205. Then casually, I saw this 308, and it looked like a dog. And I thought, oh, I wonder what idiot's going to end up buying that. And then the next day, because I'd been saving up to get a house, and I thought, well, with COVID, I'd be crazy to buy a house because prices will plummet, right? So I thought, well, I have this money for a deposit. I'm not going to buy a house for a couple of years now. So I could do something with it. And as I was going through an hour before the auction, I thought, do you know what? I could get that 308 and it will be great because I can just keep it for a year, fiddle with it and use it for YouTube, get the Ferrari thing out the window. I didn't have family or dependents, so I didn't need to worry about that too much. Get that out the window and it's all done. And so I hadn't even done the normal due diligence you would do, which is look at MOT history, all that stuff. I literally on a, you know, I'm there.
A whim.
I went in. Buying a Ferrari on a whim.
And I was shocked when I won the auction. And that's how it happened. And then that was great. So the channel went in a few months up from 12,000 subscribers up to 60,000.
Wow.
So a bit more, you know, a bit more of a proper solid footing. And I had lots of, it was the perfect time. Because first of all, you know, a lot of people were living vicariously through me. Guys my age, generally, they have responsibilities, so they can take that risk. I was in a little rented house on a new build estate with a single garage. I worked on a driveway, and I think people like that because you're not anybody special.
Yep.
I made loads of mistakes because I'm not a mechanic. I just thought, do you know what? I could probably just about scrape a living off YouTube, just about. And I had some savings as well. I'm going to give it a go. And a cloud lifted. A cloud lifted, and I just started doing it. And to begin with, I did project cars because I thought that's what people want me to do because that's what was so successful was the Ferrari. And over time, I saw I had an Elise S1 which had a big, it was twice a Cat C. So it had a tear in the chassis and you're not supposed to fix those apparently because they're, you know, aluminium, bonded aluminium and so on. But I did. I did a Citroen BX 16 valve. I did a few other cars, but I found that it was a lot of work because they're all cars you hadn't worked on before. So it's a big learning curve. Mm. You have to pay for parts. And I wasn't going to be able to do it long term. But I noticed I'd still do the odd review. And I noticed that the reviews would do, sometimes they'd do less views. So at the time, the project stuff would get between 30 and 50,000 or 30 and 40,000. But the, you know, the car reviews would get maybe sometimes 20 or 15, but sometimes 50 or 60 or 70. And the car review, I didn't have to pay for any parts.
Yeah.
It was recorded at that point. It took me a lot longer, but say in 4 hours. And then the editing would, at that point, again, would probably take me a couple of days, which is a lot less than a week's work. And so I pivoted to doing exclusively car reviews, which some people didn't like. Because obviously you build up an audience and they expect a certain thing, but it just wasn't viable for me. Some people, Matt Armstrong, a monster.
Yeah.
They can make it work. And, you know, he's younger, he's energetic, he's amazing, fantastic. I couldn't make that work. So I decided I'd keep doing the odd project, but I'd center on that. And that's been the story. And it's been great. You know, it's grown much faster than I hoped, doing much better than I hoped. And I constantly have to pinch myself.
Yeah, so that was going to be my thing because I sort of imagined that project cars were the original roadmap, if you like, excuse the pun, for the channel. And then you get into a situation where you're doing reviews and obviously the reviews are going well. Talk us through, how does that process work? Because you're reviewing other people's cars, aren't you? So how does that two-way street come about?
And do you have to say yes and do you have to say no, thank you?
Are there two lists?
There are. So essentially, I'm doing what I'm interested in. I'm really selfish, but I'm doing the cars that I have an interest in. And generally, they'll go from sort of mid-50s, not all of them, but some mid-50s up to early 2000s. Mm. Modern cars I have almost zero interest in. And so there's that sort of range of cars. They don't have to be fancy. They don't have to be fast. If they're interesting, you know, I did a Renault 4 recently, the old Renault 4. Brilliant, fantastic car, slow as anything, amazing, incredible story. I'll do it. So generally speaking, I'll tell people, yes, that's great. I'd love to do it. Also, I'm booked quite far ahead because I book about 3 or 4 months ahead. So usually, you know, if it's something that's not a priority, I can sort of put it off or, you know, sort of move it along to some other point and then we can talk again. But you know, I do get offered modern stuff and I very rarely take it up. I do sometimes, but not that much. And of course, doing 100 cars a year, more or less, it works out because it's wow. 2 a week. It's becoming a bit harder to keep going. So I think occasionally now I'm skipping. I used to do 2 a week. Now I do sometimes 1 a week. Also, just not because I can't do it, but because I'm kind of want to leave something in reserve for later. So I don't want to do everything, you know, all at once and then be stuck without anything to do.
Having to force yourself into a modern car.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's the beauty of the channel, though, isn't it, I think? And sort of going back to what you said before about being that guy that works on the drive, you know, you're not in some kind of sort of flash garage setup with all the tools. I think that's all part of the appeal, certainly for me, is that, you know, I would hazard a guess that we're all of a certain age, and therefore the sort of the cars that you pick, which are important to you and those that really spark something in your childhood. I think that's the appeal, isn't it? Because we look at it and kind of go, I used to have one of them, or exactly. Indeed, I wanted to have one of them.
Yeah.
The amount of cars that literally, you know, when I was young, I might see in the corner of my eye, or that you'd see somewhere, like the Renault 5 Turbo, the, you know, the first series, which was in the Bond film, you know, the mid-engine little monster. And that you dream, I'd never have dreamt about driving them. And I've pretty much, the heroes, I have to say, I've almost driven them all. You know, those cars that, you know, they're from a wide range of times, but I've almost driven them all. And it just, I have to pinch myself. It's just, you know, it's just amazing. And generally, I think you asked before and I didn't answer, the way it works is that in the videos, I say, you know, there's a little script, I used to say it now, there's a little bit that comes up saying, you know, if you want me to review your car, mm-hmm. please get in touch. So 99.9% of the cars that I review are just people getting in touch with me. And I have a location that I film at because I'm a one-man band. And I have filmed, and I used to do it a lot more, you know, in the earlier days, filming in unknown locations, and it doesn't work. And it's massively stressful. So I don't know where I'm going. And I'm thinking about the cameras and I'm thinking about mm-hmm. what I'm supposed to say. And we're trying to find a location where I can do an introduction, which is quiet and not ugly. And it just doesn't work. And most people seem happy to sort of come to me. Mm-hmm. I've had people coming to me from Germany, from Belgium, from France.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. Oh. You know, they're just incredible, you know, what people are happy to do. It really, it makes me feel humble to think someone's going to come.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, they'll do a bit of a touristy thing, but they're principally coming to have their car filmed.
But it's lovely because everyone shares the passion because we all love those cars and they're as excited to see their car on the screen as you are to drive it. I totally get it. It's lovely. Mm.
And the beautiful thing about this is that I generally, a couple of times a week, just get to meet up with people who I invariably really like because they're exactly like me and they have the same interests, the same sort of outlook. They're just really nice, lovely people. Mm. And I really enjoy that part of it, is just meeting the owners. And while I film some of it anyway, we can sort of chat and find out more. And then usually, if I have time, I'll take them for lunch afterwards. And it's just brilliant.
It's a celebration, isn't it? You know, ultimately, again, you know, sort of a cliche, the star's the car. The star's the car? The car's the star, even. I knew it didn't sound right. The car's a star in your videos. And it is a pure celebration of that. So listen, let's go back to the very beginning then. What are the earliest motoring memories? What first stirred something inside you when it comes to cars? Because obviously you are, you know, you're a dyed-in-the-wool petrol head and you're living the dream.
Yeah. So funnily enough, you know, people often say, oh, my dad was a real petrol head. My parents.
Or my mum, can I just say?
Yeah, no, that's what I was going to say. That's why I said parents. Yeah. No, neither of them had the slightest interest in cars. I mean, nothing. And I just remember, though, he had good jobs. And one of the company cars he had at the time, I think, was a 5. They did a 516, I think, in the first 5 series.
Ooh,
so tiny engine.
518, wasn't it?
Maybe
I think,
518. Yeah. Anyway, we lived in a high-rise in Milan. And I remember looking down when he first arrived with it. And I saw it in the parking lot. And then we went out and had a look at it. And it just looked great. I think it was one of those sort of pea green colours of the 70s.
Super cool.
So that was one of my first memories. But also, just remember, we used to go on holiday back. We were in the north, but we used to go on holiday to the south of Italy, which is beautiful. Amalfi Coast and on. Yeah. And then volcanic islands off Sicily. So always long drives in the summer. And at one stage, I think he had an Alfetta, something along those lines. And I used to sit in the back, and in the evening, at nighttime, I could see reflected in my window two little lights that were just, I don't know, there was, I don't know what they were for, but there was always at night time in the dash, there was a red and green light on the side. And that would reflect in that window. I used to sit there looking out, seeing whatever I could and seeing those two little lights. And I don't know why. I mean, it doesn't make sense, but that just stuck with me. And it's, you know, it takes me back in time and it brings me back to these older cars. And there's lots of, you know, bizarre little memories like that. My mum had a 2CV. So, you know, I remember that. I always remember the
quirky push and twist gear stick.
It couldn't have been more French, could it?
No, exactly. What was your first car, Jack? After all your Alfa stories, it's got to have been Italian.
Yes. My first car was the absolutely awesome Fiat Uno Eleganza 45, which was a dealer-only model in the UK. So it was a light metallic blue, and it had such incredible luxuries as painted bumpers. So it was one, you know, it was all one colour. And then it had some absolutely hideous sort of plastic wheel covers. But that was it. That was the first car. Passed my test in it. That's what I had and what I drove. And it was a bit rubbish. I mean, you know, the Uno was all right. The 45 was really gutless. And it also had a very rubbery gear change. So I have fond memories of it. But it wasn't, you know, I've been very spoiled since then. But maybe we can go into that later. But that was my first, my first car. And we were all car mad at the time. You know, everybody was car mad. I think it's a bit different now. You know, for us, it was just a part of who you were almost.
Well, I think now that you've got, you know, so many taxis and Ubers and better bus routes and stuff like that. It's just...
I wonder, you know, in terms of the next generation, you know, and we've got kids of a similar age, is that whether they will actually have that same passion for cars that we had because of exactly what you said, because transport almost becomes a thing on an app as opposed to being... You know, the only thing I wanted to do when I was a kid was pass my driving test. I wasn't interested in GCSEs or A-levels or any of that stuff. I just wanted to get that qualification. And almost from the age of about two or three, that's all I really aspired to do, genuinely.
Oh, so sweet.
It's true, though. You know, and ultimately, that's why we're here.
Yeah. Jack, how old were you when you passed your test?
I think I was 18, but I'll be honest here. I think I definitely failed it once. Did I fail it twice? Actually, hold on. I had a bike test as well. Okay, I failed my bike test twice, so that wasn't good. And my car test, do you know, I can't remember if I passed it first time round or not. But I was 18.
I think then you didn't pass first time.
Because I think you'd remember.
Those of us who did pass first time don't let anyone ever forget about it. Dave, first time? Yeah.
First time, but literally, but I've been waiting for approximately 15 years. To achieve that, you know, and it was a big day.
Since the age of two.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, it's very, very true. So listen, in terms of the here and now, or rather the recent history, what's in the current fleet, Jack? What do you have at the time of recording? And what have you perhaps got your eye on?
So having said all that, I do have two modern cars, but bear with me. One of them is a really obvious reason why I have it, but it's an Alpine. And the reason why I have it is because it's the only modern car that gives a nod to the older stuff. Yeah. So I love the concept behind it, which is all aluminium. Mm-hmm. It's all about lightweight. It's all about efficiency. For me, and this won't register with my other car. Yeah, but for me, I love efficiency. I love cars that work well with the minimum, you know, so they go fast because they're light, not because they have a massive engine. And so I loved everything about it. Mm. I don't like the flappy paddle gearbox, although I've got used to it. But I had a Lotus Elise S1 before that, which was the one that was originally bent and which I fixed and so on. And I never used it because you used to have to take the car cover off. You used to have to take the roof off. If it had rained, you didn't know where to put the cover. It was a faff. So I never used it. So I thought, and it kept going wrong because they're really simple cars, but they have an uncanny ability to go wrong. So I was never using it. So I thought, right, I want something modern, still sporty, that I'll enjoy. I like those. YouTube had been going well. So I sold the Elise, got the Alpine. So that's car number one. And I do really like it. I think it is great. Car number two is my daily, and it's an Alfa 159.
The black one that you...
The black one, yeah. the station wagon or wagon,
it's
whatever 1.8
they call it.
1.8 TBI. Now, the 159 is notoriously un-Alfa-like. right? They're too heavy. They don't drive like alphas. The 1.8 TBI is supposed to be the most alpha-like because it has an alpha engine, unlike the others that had GM engines. It's also the lightest engine, so it's supposed to be the best to drive. It's still pretty much akin to just an Audi for me. It still doesn't draw you in. It doesn't drive like an alpha. It doesn't feel that much like an alpha. It looks beautiful. It's got a lovely interior. It's much more solid than previous alphas. Yeah. But that's my daily. I was going to sell it. Then as part of the video where I said I'm going to sell this car, I did all the research into the history of it.
That's why I'm surprised that you still got it, because obviously that's what
I decided not to sell it, right? Because I found that they'd spent £12,000 on that car in the last 4 years.
Yes. And you bought it for?
I bought it for 6.5, which is probably what it's worth.
Yeah.
But it's more just the fact that having had all that money spent on it, it's a really good car.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get a Giulia, which is a modern car, but again, good fun. But you'd have to spend a lot more money. It would depreciate. And all why? Because the 159 dynamically isn't amazing. But it doesn't matter that much. I have an Alpine. And I have the third car.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, which makes a mockery of a lot of what I've said
still,
so far.
Sorry, still one drive?
Well, I have a double garage,
okay,
which is why I bought this house. Yeah. It's the smallest house I could find with a double garage.
Understood.
And so there's a little drive outside the garage, and then there's a drive outside the house. So I potentially have room for more, and I did. But I've gone down to a solid three-car routine because it's just too much of a hassle. Mm-hmm.
What is number three?
So number three is a nice, efficient, light, small car. It's a 1973 Detamazzo Pantera with a 5.7-litre.
I mean, just simple and understated and sensible.
And very, very quiet.
I mean, those were genuinely, I don't think, with the exception of going to car shows, I don't think I've ever seen one in real life on the street, you know, because you don't. I've seen them at like Silverstone Classic and whatnot. Mm. But they were, again, for people of our age, they were a poster car, weren't they? I mean, they really were. They were the thing of Athena posters in the 90s.
Yeah.
So the thing is, I had this Ferrari 308 known as the Influenza, and I did loads of work to it, and it would have bankrupted and killed a normal person. I did all the work on it myself, and it worked because it blew up the channel. But for a normal person, it would have been terrible. But after 2.5 years, I was in a position to sell it and move it on. In that time, I'd done loads of reviews of things, and I did a review on two Panteras, a late wide body and an earlier car. Mm-hmm. And there's just something about them I couldn't quite put my finger on that, for me, it really drew me in. The car that came before, the Mangusta, is probably one of my all-time favourites, but they're £500,000. Mm. So that was a no-go. The Pantera, something about it that I couldn't resist. Mm. And so sold the Ferrari, and I'd already made contact by then with basically Mr. Pantera in the US. Mike Drew knows all about them, and he was keeping an eye out. And he found a project car for me in Oklahoma. And I flew over to see it. And it was a part finished sort of restoration. And bought it. Oh, there's all videos about all this and going over there and buying it. Then brought it back here. And it was a lot more work than,
God,
than
it, I expected. They always are, aren't they?
I mean,
I know, but this
there's a common thread here, isn't there? Because you know that you live in the dream when you're flying to Oklahoma to look for a project car.
Yeah.
It was amazing. And the Influenza was only about, I couldn't make it at the time, but it was only 6-hour drive away in Texas because it had just landed in Texas, but it hadn't cleared customs. Otherwise, I could have popped over.
Right.
But this car was, unfortunately, the owner passed away before he finished restoring it. So it was Mike Drew, Mr. Pantera, sold it to me as, do you want a car that you just have to reassemble? Because it's, you know, he's done all the work already and all you have to do is put it together. It's brand new paint, brand new engine, brand new everything. Yeah.
Good sales pitch.
Yeah. Went to see it and Oklahoma was amazing. And, you know, his shed was literally three times the size of my house. Mm. And he had another one. And he'd done a lot of work to this car, but the paint had reacted over time, although he'd never used it. It had been done 6 years prior, and it wasn't a great job, so it had reacted. And he had a vision for this car, which was, you know, a black car with lots of chrome. In the 90s, Panteras, they weren't worth very much, and people were trying to front date them. And I think he had that vision in mind, which wasn't the same as mine. So one thing and another, by the time I got it back here, it ended up being a full engine rebuild, a full repaint. And because I was repainting it, I looked at the original colour. The original colour was silver, not my thing. Mm-hmm. It was black, which I would have kept if it was fine.
Yeah.
But because didn't want to do it silver, wasn't black, complete repaint, I thought, right, I'm going to do a colour that I love. And I looked at what colours they came in, and there's a lime green, which is like the Mura colour.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which, like... And I thought, that's it. And so I painted it lime green. So as well as being unbelievably loud, I've literally driven it for the first time in the last 2 or 3 weeks. I've done 50 miles in it, shaking it down. It's that colour. So it's honestly a bit embarrassing, but I love it.
So how, when you're looking for something new, and obviously has to fit in with the three-car garage at any point, how much of it is what you want and how much of it is what you think the channel might be hungry for? Because there must be a certain business decision at times, because there are certain cars that you know that you're going to get lots and lots of content out of. So how important is that in a percentage?
So in the past, it used to be really important. It used to be 90%.
Right.
You know, what will work on the channel, which generally probably means I'd be interested in it anyway.
Yeah.
But that's when I was doing work on the cars. As I've been doing reviews of other cars, luckily, it no longer really matters mm-hmm. because the project stuff that I do is a tiny percentage. So the Pantera videos, the updates on my Alpha, yeah. the Alpine videos, is maybe 10% of the numbers that I get on the channel. So luckily, I've been freed from that. And so when I buy something now, like the Pantera, I didn't think that was going to be a big... you know, cash cow, and it hasn't been so far mm-hmm. at all. It probably gets the lowest amount of views. You know, videos get between the just update videos, maybe 50 to 60, 70,000 okay. views, whereas reviews hover more around 100,000. Mm. So, at the moment, thankfully, it doesn't really, I get what I want. You know, I always wanted a 159. I'd read they weren't that good. And it's true, they're not that good, but still, you know, it's all right. And I've got to stop being so stupid, because you convince yourself that you have to get something specific from a car. And all it is that when it's new, you're interested in it. And as you get used to it, you find more and more reasons to get another rush by selling it and buying another car. And often that doesn't actually make much sense. You know, you kind of have to appreciate what you have. And I'm unbelievably lucky with what I have. You know, I have a car I can use every day. I have a car for fun, which works all the time, the Alpine. And then I have an outrageous thing, which I just love, you know.
Is there one car that you still need to get that's on the poster, on the wall?
Do you know what? I'm not sure if there is. There are cars that I would really like to get. But I'm trying to be a bit more sensible now. And in the past, I sort of rushed out, because it's quite easy to buy cars, especially when they're broken and cheap. And then you get saddled with these chains around your ankle where you have a project you don't have time for. It's sucking up money and it becomes stressful. And I did it so many times that I think I've gradually learned to not do that. So right now, I'm fine. The 159 at some point will go. But, you know, I was going to sell it, decided not to. I had lots of people saying I'll buy it. And I was like, I'm really sorry. I kind of... decided maybe it doesn't make that much sense.
So you're happy for now?
Yeah, I'm really happy for now. The Alpine will probably go at some point. I don't know if it's a forever keeper. You know, I like sort of 70s, 80s things, and there are lots of them potentially. I had an R32 for a while, mm-hmm. GTR. Never had an interest in Japanese cars. At the same time, I had an Integrale.
Yeah.
And the Integrale actually, I found a bit of a letdown because I expected so much from it. And it does deliver, but it took me a while to find it. You have to drive it so hard that it's always ragged on the edge and you can't appreciate much of the time. And it also feels like it's going to fall apart every minute. The R32, I expected nothing from and was blown away.
Absolute rocket.
But just how amazing the engine was. And they were the other thing.
It's the RB26 engine, isn't it?
Yeah. The other thing that really shocked me is that was the same price as the Integrale at the time. And it felt like, you know, a lot of hate for this, but it felt like twice the car. You know, it felt like a car, a class up, and, you know, more sophisticated, better in many ways. So, you know, I'd love to have one of those again, but they're silly money. A lot of stuff has really gone up. When I first started the channel, I did a series which was 12 cars. I was supposed to buy and sell 12 cars in 12 months that I'd always wanted. Mm-hmm. And the budget was £15,000. And I managed to get an R32. I managed to get a Lotus Esprit Turbo. I managed to get, I won't go into the list now, but, you know, I did lots of them. But nowadays, you know, I'd love to have a Mangusta. You know, prices are falling. maybe at some point, who knows. But they're better. They are okay to drive. They're not as bad as people think. But to be honest, the Pantera is better to drive. And it's mainly the looks of the Mangusta that I really just do something to me. You know, it was in Kill Bill?
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
And I saw it without knowing what it was and thinking it was some sort of Maserati. I saw the back of it and I've always been intrigued. And then when I found out it was that car, it was like, oh, you know, it does something to me. So, yeah, so that's, I think that's it at the moment. There are lots of cars. I'd like a Lancia Fulvia, you know, always wanted one, never had. That's one of the cars I've always, lots of them I've had. That's one I've never had for one reason or another, which I'd quite like. And that may happen at some point, actually, because they're small. They're not that expensive. Yeah. So it's doable. It would fit in the garage next to the Pantera, so I could talk myself into it.
Is it fair to say that you've never found your true motoring love so far? And the reason I say that is because normally people say there's one car that they would never sell. However, so far, it seems to me that there's never been that one car that would never sell. Even the ones that you've got now could be for sale at the right time, at the right place. Is that a fair assessment?
Has been up till now, but in theory, the Pantera is the keeper. So that is the car that for the first time ever, I've really thought, I think if I sell this, all I'm going to have left is a really cheap little daily when I'm in my 80s or something. Mm. That's the idea. You can never say 100%, but really, I do think so. But up till now, it is true that I've got into cars, and then after a little while, I've kind of, some of them I like more than others, but I've eventually lost interest. I do like to experience, you know, new things.
Mm-hmm. Time for the final question, I'm afraid, Jack, if that's all right. And it's going to be your dream drive. So you need to transport us there. Where are you going? What are you listening to? And most importantly, what are you driving?
Okay. So I have family and a lot of history in the lakes area in Italy. So Lake Maggiore in particular, and next to it, there's a small lake called Lake Orta. And they're really picturesque, amazing. I have incredible memories from when I was young. Mm-hmm. You know, my grandparents' house was there, all sorts of stuff. Aww. And obviously I want to go there in the Pantera. There's nothing else. Italian car, American engine, but Italian car, Italian spirit. I want to go in the Pantera. And at some stage, I know it's such a cliche, but I would want to listen to the Matt Monro song that, you know, from the film.
Gotta and, be.
I've forgotten what it's called. Do you remember what it's called? These Days or something like that? It's at the beginning of the Michael Caine film.
Not the beginning of the Italian Job.
Yes, the Italian Job. Where he's driving the
Mura.
Through the tunnel. That's the song, Matt Monro, and it's Days Like This. Mm. Right? I know I don't have a Mura, whatever, but it's
not,
just
not
that
yet,
song.
You don't.
Yeah, I mean, but it's that song, and to me, it's what it represents, and I'll be on the, you know, on the shore, on these roads, on the side of the lake, and it'll be amazing, and I'll do a wider trip through Italy. If I, you know, I can't do it now because it would just kill me financially with the amount of fuel that thing uses. It would have to wait till prices go back down a bit. But that's my dream drive.
You know, I knew it was going to be Italian.
Yeah, of course.
I knew it was going to be Italian. Yeah. And I'm delighted that it was and is, in fact, because it keeps with the whole theme. And that's just about it for this week's edition of Fueling Around, brought to you by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs, helping save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance.
And if you haven't already checked out Jack's channel, it is called Number 27 on YouTube. You will get lost and spend hours there. So thank you very much to our special guest this week, Jack Pigoraro.
Absolutely. No, it's been a real pleasure. And also, don't forget to press the subscribe button on YouTube so that you never miss one of our episodes, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, bye-bye.